let's take something important like the design of election ballots. And let's take the fact that in the United States, 48% of adults read in a categorization called low literacy, ninth grade level or below. How do you design election ballots so those people's votes get counted the way that they feel?
Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk. I am a career coach for tech managers and CEO of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is Jared Spool. He is co-founder, co-CEO, and maker of awesomeness at Center Center. Welcome, Jared.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to chat today, Jared. So let's start at the beginning with Center Center and what do you do? So tell us about that and what your mission is.
So our mission at Center Center is to eliminate all the bad design in the world. And we figure it's sort of a 100-year mission. And the companies underlying Center Center have been around. This is our 30th year. So we've got 70 more years to go.
I love it. That's a great outlook. And when you say eliminating bad design in the world, how is what I'm curious. So just basically, do you consider yourselves more of like a training company, consulting, maybe a little bit of a blend of the two?
Well, so the big question of how is we don't know, right? The beauty of it is we have 70 years to figure it out. When we started 30 years ago, we thought that what we needed to understand was, well, how does good design happen? How does bad design happen? So we needed to think in terms of what those what causes good design and what causes bad design. That so we spent much of the first half of the 30 years studying design and trying to understand how does design happen in the first place. I mean, how do things get designed? And then when they get poorly designed, what are the people who are creating poor designs doing differently from the people who are doing great designs? Is it that the people with great designs have some special secret talent that they're born with, or that the people who create poor designs don't, or is there something else going on? And what we learned in that first adventure was that really the difference between good design and bad design is really about understanding who the users are and what they're trying to do, and then understanding the mediums by which we create design with. And we spent a lot of time trying to understand the mediums, whether those mediums are, you know, in today's terms, a website or a desktop app or a phone app, or even things that are not digital, forms, ballots, refrigerators. You know, we tried to understand what the sort of mediums were and what the practices are. And it turns out there are some practices there. But a lot of it has to do with the experience that people have with their users. What do the experiences that those users encounter have when someone runs into something that's frustrating? Why is it frustrating? When someone runs into something that's delightful, why is it delightful? And the process by which the organization that created the thing invests in understanding what makes frustrating things frustrating, what makes delightful things delightful, they get into this point where they can manipulate and choose an outcome. And so now much of our work for the last decade or so has been around understanding why organizations choose to create something that's a poor design, because it's very much a choice. It may be a indirect consequence of other choices, but it's very much a choice. And so our work now is around understanding those choices and helping organizations make better choices.
Yeah, and that can be a tough pill to swallow for some folks. When you say that organizations choose to create poor design, are they aware that that's the choice they're making in your experience? Or is it like 2020 hindsight?
Sometimes. Sometimes they're aware, sometimes they're not. Say most of the time, it's out of what we call unconscious incompetence.
Yeah.
Right. They're not very good, but you know, when you first start learning something, to get really good at it, you have to go through four stages. And the first stage is what we call unconscious incompetence. Mm-hmm. Unconscious incompetence is when somebody isn't good at what they do. They're incompetent at it. And of course, they've never done it before. Mm-hmm. So why would they be good at it? But they don't know they're not good at it. So, you know, someone who's learning how to cook, for example, or learning a new language or learning a musical instrument, you know, they pick it up and the fact that they can make the instrument do anything, or they can make something that is, you know, borderline edible is like such an amazing feat for them. They love right. it.
I'm awesome right? at this. I'm such a good cook. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And you know, we encourage them. We're like, oh, that's very nice. You know, don't yep. give it up. Keep working at it.
Yeah.
And so they keep doing it. But because they're unconsciously incompetent, unconsciously means they just don't know that they're bad at it. And they think they're good at it. I mean, after all, you know, they moved their fingers and food came out or music came out.
Sure.
This is amazing, right? And yeah, it doesn't quite taste like, you know, the restaurant version, but it's good. It's okay. I made it. I can be proud of it. And yes. so that notion of unconscious incompetence is huge. Yeah. And then at some point, usually a close friend will say, hey, that thing you do, can you please stop? It's not very good.
I know. It's like, oh, man. I mean, it's almost like, oh, that hurts. But
exactly.
you need to hear it. And that's when it becomes, when you become aware of it. That's when right. it becomes conscious.
And yeah. and the difference there is that suddenly you now know there's a difference between good and bad. And you are learning that you are not on the good side.
Yeah.
And a lot of people give up at that moment.
This is too hard. Oh, man, it took me this long to get this far, and now I need to get good at it. Yeah, right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you know, every one of us was an amazing artist until the age of 6 or 7. Everything we did went into the art gallery, yeah. which was the refrigerator. Sure. And we got oohs and ahs, and it was always fantastic. And then somebody said, you can't draw. Stop drawing. And we stop drawing. We say, well, we can't draw, right? And we're immediately at this point where we believe we're not good at this. And of course, that's when we give up. But some people persist. Mm-hmm. And that persistence causes them to start learning techniques, learning methods. And in the process of learning techniques and methods, they are now in a place where they can go forward and start to learn how to do a decent job on a consistent basis. If they follow the recipe, the food turns out pretty good. If they put their fingers on the right place on the instrument and follow the sheet music exactly, the song turns out pretty good. So suddenly they are learning what it takes, and they can consistently produce good outcomes, but they have to think about it each moment. So they go from initially unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence, and now they're at conscious competence. Mm-hmm. And that works, and they can keep being at conscious competence until they get to the next moment. And the next moment is when they get to this point where they realize they don't have to think about it to do a decent job. They can walk into the kitchen and whip up a meal and it comes out pretty good, and they didn't have a recipe and they were thinking about other things while they were doing it, but they've done it so many times they know exactly how to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's what we call unconscious competence. And so to answer your original question, many of the design teams that are putting out bad design are unconsciously incompetent. They, as far as they're concerned, they made some effort and out came a website or out came a phone app or out came a sales process, and they sold something and it must have worked. And how bad can that be? And so that's where they're at.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can totally see the parallels from to whipping up dinner to in the parallel to whipping up a website. I'm having memories back to some of the very first websites that I built in the 90s. And so some listeners and perhaps you too, Jared, can relate. You know, the first websites that we've ever built. Oh, hey, cool. I put something on the World Wide Web. Cool. Somebody can go to www. And I did this. Like, I built this from scratch. But when we look at them now, we're like, oh gosh, you know, 1995 called, they want their website back. But and it, but then it's like those people who said, you know what, I want to get really good at this. I know that there has to be a better way to do this. And that now it's like, all right, you need to tell me that this sucks so that I can get better at it, so that I can make it better. It's not just about putting something on a screen. It's about making the user experience awesome. It's not just about the conversions. It's about other stuff too. And so what I'm wondering is, so I love the unconscious incompetence piece of it. You know, why organizations might choose to create poor design. That's an important distinction there. Have you found, though, that some organizations, some individuals choose to create poor design consciously?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that.
The most time it happens is when they've made the conscious decision to separate who their users are from who their customers are. The obvious case of this is advertising-based companies.
Yeah.
Companies that have revenue, their primary revenue model is from advertising. Their customers, the one who pays the bills, are not the users. And the users actually are not excited about the customers. Right. You look at many mainstream media websites now, particularly things like local news and local newspapers, and the websites are horrible.
Yeah.
It's really hard to read an article on those sites. You go because there's some piece of news. I mean, I live up in the north of Boston in the Andover Lawrence area, and a month and a half ago, all hell broke loose when 70 fires spontaneously broke out because of a gas explosion.
Yeah,
and getting the news on what happened and how it affected the community has been incredibly difficult because you go to these local websites who have the boots on the ground and they're the ones reporting the stories. And they've got decent journalism, but that journalism is completely clouded by all of these ads and all of these interruptions and the pop-ups and the videos that magically appear in the middle of the article while you're trying to read it that have nothing to do with the article.
Right.
And all of these experiences. And that's all on purpose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For sure.
Right.
That wasn't an oath. That was, we want to do this because our ads, because they're usually ads. And that's
right.
Where they,
because
that's where they
in order
money.
To make the customers happy,
yeah,
customers, the users have to see the ads. Yeah. The users don't want to see the ads. right? And the browsers have now built in modes so that you can get rid of the ads. You press a button and all the ads go away. They call reader mode,
sure,
right?
Yep.
And the websites are angry at this.
Right, because their customers aren't the users. Their customers are the advertisers. And I, you know what, and I'm thinking about, you know, websites like Medium, for example, where there's no ads. At least I don't believe there are. So when you think of the experience on something like Medium, where the customers are the people who are reading, you know, that experience is just so much nicer to read. I never even thought about it that way. I guess we become ad blind to a certain extent. We put on those blinders because we're just so used to seeing it. But when you compare something like Medium to like a local news site, that the differences become just so obvious. So that's a great example there of people consciously choosing to do bad design, and they know it.
Right. Yeah. And so now, but how does Medium make money?
I don't know. Do you?
Well, they've been experimenting with subscriptions.
Okay.
But they haven't found a subscription model that works.
All right.
So I don't think they're making money. But it wouldn't surprise me to find out, and I don't know this for a fact, but they're building a network. So they know quite a bit about who you are based on what you read. Mm-hmm. And who you follow and what you clap for and what links you click on in emails. They're learning a lot about you. And the technology exists today that they can connect you to other things. So they, for instance, can connect you to your Facebook account.
Yeah.
And because Facebook has asked you to use two-factor authentication. Mm-hmm. And in the process of using two-factor authentication, they need your cell number so they can send you the little six-digit code so you can log in. Mm-hmm. They now know your cell number. And because they now know your cell number, they know your address. They know the cars you've bought. They know how much your house is worth. They know what your credit limit is. And so they now have, you know, what student loans you have, yeah, what schools you went to. So they now have a tremendous amount of information that they can sell to somebody else. And so you are not the customer of Medium. You are just a user of Medium.
Sure.
They are selling you.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And so it's that model.
They haven't disclosed any of this. And of course, this is 100% conjecture on my point.
Sure. Part. Right.
But this is actually trivial for them to do, and nothing in the end user license agreement that you agreed to without reading prevents them from doing this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's no law that says they have to disclose that they're doing this to for you.
Yeah.
So now, if you tend to gravitate to certain politics in your reading, they know your political point of view. And they can start to put ads up wherever you go, not on Medium, but other places,
yeah,
that feed that political point of view. And that's how the Russians did it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, exactly. And
so, and that's all intentional.
Right. Yeah. So getting back to what we were talking about before, they are intentionally doing that. And it's a design choice to do that. And so while I'd love to talk, you know, dive even deeper into this whole world of ads and politics and what companies are intentionally versus unintentionally doing. Perhaps we could have you on the podcast again, Jared. That's a whole rabbit hole that I'd
love
to.
Well, remind me when we do that to talk about the interview that the executive for Ford Motor Company did with NPR yesterday, where he basically said they're going to start making money off of selling data they get from your car.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to check that out. I am doing that like today. But yeah, definitely. That is a rabbit hole that is worth jumping down and is relevant to design and also relevant to data as well. And so the reason that I'm pivoting is because one of the things, one of the topics that I was super excited to talk to you about, Jared, is data in general. I am a data geek. I was a college professor. I was a researcher for almost 10 years. So for almost 10 years of my life, like, data was my life, doing analyses, jumping into SPSS, and leading data analytics teams. And I saw your talk at Business of Software. I definitely suggest folks check that out when the Business of Software folks post those videos. They usually post the videos of all the talks. But I was looking through my notes from your Business of Software talk this year, and one of my favorite quotes, which I think is relevant to this conversation today, you said during this talk, If you torture data long enough, it'll confess to anything. And I think I remember, like, laughing out loud, like belly laugh, when you said that during the talk, because it resonates so much with me. But it's funny because it's true, that if you torture data long enough, it will confess to anything. So I'm curious, from your perspective, what are some of your favorite examples of people torturing data?
Well, I mean, the obvious things that you hear about all the time are the folks who carefully trim the data to remove data points, or to obscure or accentuate aspects of the data that are not really representative of reality. So just playing with the axes on a chart, for example, yeah, instead of showing percentages from 0 to 100, if all the data falls in between 10% and 12%, mm-hmm, having the axes start at 8% and go up to 13% makes changes in that data look really big, when in fact the changes in that data are probably pretty flat.
Like fractions of percentage or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Always exactly. Look at your y-axis, folks. Does it start at zero? Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. So that somebody was talking to me about correlations between a business metric and growth of companies in the airline industry. And they specifically picked 2016 as the year to compare to. So that was suspicious to me, right? Why would they not just pick an entire decade or two decades? But no, they looked at 1 year, and then they carefully eliminated American Airlines and US Air, because that was the year that they merged. Maybe it was 2014, yeah. So that was the year that they merged.
Yeah.
And they eliminated that data because it was an outlier. I'm like, okay, when they merged, they became the biggest airline. And you're talking about growth. And so, yeah, but they didn't grow naturally, he says. They, you know, they grew through this. And then, you know, I said, if it had supported your hypothesis that this business metric worked, you would have kept their data in, wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. So, okay.
Gotcha.
So you removed the data, and then you found a post hoc rationalization for why the data wasn't there. And this is why you're picking that year. Show me 2013. Show me 2012. Show me the decade between 2003 and 2013. Mm-hmm. I want to see the growth there. Well, the data doesn't match up. He had a million reasons why he couldn't do that. I'm like, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're not winning this argument with me. If your theory is correct, I should be able to pick any random year and it will work. Well, it's not going to work 100%. Nothing works 100%. Mm-hmm. It should come close.
It should.
Show me that it comes close.
Yep. Yeah.
Well,
yeah. Yeah, that's a hard look in the mirror for some folks. And what you were talking about with the post hoc rationalization reminded me of something that my graduate school advisor would point out from time to time. And look, this happens in the scientific literature as well. You know, so this is supposed to be an area where people don't do that kind of stuff, but it happens all the time. And I remember we were reading one particular article. And she said, they're harking here. So I just want to let you know they're harking. And I'm like, what's harking? Harking, hypothesizing after the results are known. So basically, right, we know the results. So we're going to hypothesize this. So it's very similar. These are the results that I want to mend and carefully trim the data to make it support. And that's just, that's, if you, that's not science. that's not
using data. I love that phrase. I'm going to write that down. Hypothesizing after results are known.
Yeah,
that's brilliant. I mean, people do this all the time. And here's the thing about science. Most scientific studies cannot be reproduced.
You're right. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree.
There's this sort of classic behavioral study called the marshmallow test, where the idea is the original study involved putting marshmallows on a table in front of a six-year-old and telling them that they can have the marshmallow if they just wait 2 minutes, and then leaving the room and telling them they need to wait 2 minutes before they have the marshmallow. And theoretically, kids who have a higher self-control index will wait for those 2 minutes before they put the marshmallow in their mouth, whereas ones who aren't good at self-control will put the marshmallow in their mouth immediately. And this has been there are all sorts of inferences and subsequent hypotheses that were taken from this that showed that were supposed to show that kids with this high level of self-control come from more affluent families. And you know, there was all these sort of correlations that were sort of starting to come about using this marshmallow test as a basic fundamental metric, except that no one can reproduce the original results.
Yeah.
Everyone's tried, or not everyone, but lots of people have tried, and the results don't reproduce. You can't get people to do them a second time. It's interesting that we find a study that supports our hypothesis, and we say, see, that study proves it. Now we're going to jump off that as a foundational idea. Mm-hmm. And turns out, nope, most things don't reproduce.
Yeah, that's just one study. What I would say from the scientific perspective would be find 10 studies. If you could find 10 studies and if you can find 20 studies and there's a pattern there, they're not going to find exactly the same things. But if you could find those patterns, then you might be onto something. And that becomes, you know, for the good researchers, that becomes the basis for future research. It becomes the basis for dissertations. It becomes the basis of the best, you know, the scientific articles that win the awards that aren't harking, you know, that we don't find out 10 years later that they fabricated the data, you know. So it is really about those patterns over, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 studies. And it's not just about that one study.
We forget this element of the scientific method. Right. There's a basic notion of the scientific method, which is you do an experiment, and if it turns out to be true, you've proven a hypothesis. But theoretically, it should be true every time you try it. If I take two objects of different masses and I drop them from a height, Galileo's experiment says they will, you know, if I release them at the same time, they will land at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I can reproduce that on, you know, for the next 100 years, and it will come out with the exact same results every time I do it.
Yeah.
We're not holding science to that standard anymore.
Yeah.
And part of it is the rush to create scientists and to graduate and to get your PhD. And to do all the things.
To publish, right? You got to publish. In order to get your PhD, you need to publish. In order to become a scientist, you need to publish. And it's like, okay, so if the outcome is just publishing, then okay, I'm just going to go to crap journal and put my thing in there. And then that's cool. That's good enough.
Yeah.
And so and, it's sad. And,
right. And you can't get a lot of fame. You can't get accepted to conferences. And you can't easily get published for saying, I tried to prove that that these things weren't connected, and I ran 100 experiments and they were never connected.
Yeah.
Guess what? You know, those two variables are not connected. No one's like, well, okay, who cares?
That's not cool, right? That's exactly. There's nothing new there. Yeah, we knew that already.
No, yeah. you get, but you do get published for wacky correlations, and because that's newsworthy.
Yeah.
So you know, people start talking to me about correlations. I often bring up, you can correlate, what is it, Nick Cage movies, the popularity of Nick Cage movies to the amount of cheese sold in Wisconsin.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah.
That's great.
It turns out that the divorce rate in Maine strongly correlates with the per capita consumption of margarine in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of crude oil that the U.S. imports from Norway strongly correlates with the number of drivers who are killed in railway train collisions.
Right.
And
it's right. So correlation is not causation in that, in those cases, there's some third variables. There's some third variable that both are related to, and that makes those two variables correlated to one another.
It's just coincidence.
Yeah. Right. It's not that one causes the other. They happen to be correlated because there are many other factors that they're all related to
Exactly.
Hi everyone. We'll get back to the interview in a jiffy. But first, are you a tech manager? In other words, do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you feel like you're wasting precious time going to useless meetings, dealing with administrative nonsense, and working late nights? Are you working 50 plus hours a week, but don't have the salary to show for it? It doesn't need to be that way. You can build thriving, high-performing teams who produce a measurable positive impact while earning the premium salary you deserve. Oh, and you don't have to work your butt off to get there. If this sounds like the kind of success you're striving for, then go to genbunk.com/webinar to reserve a spot in my free masterclass. I share the 4 shifts that my tech manager clients made to achieve badass career transformation. That's genbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview. I have a couple more questions for you, Jared. We have a little bit more time. So one question is to kind of bring together what we've been talking about. And then that last question is a question that I ask all of my podcast guests. So I'm kind of playing the role of podcast listener right now and sort of thinking, okay, so you guys started talking about design, and then and because I pivoted, I want to explain this pivot basically. Now you're talking about data and correlations. So I'm wondering, Jared, if you can explain what do correlations and data and analytics have to do with design?
Oh, they have a ton to do with design.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the deal. Facebook has more than 2 billion users. And every time someone clicks on a button, that's a piece of data. And if Facebook wants to make their design more effective for their 2 billion users, how do they change those buttons? Small changes are huge. Here's a place where it really makes a difference. Mm-hmm. We often think about edge cases, and we eliminate edge cases in design. We say, well, let's design for most users, and we'll take care of something for most users. We'll get it really good for most users. We're not going to worry about all the edge cases, about the people who are a little strange, about the people who are a little different, because they're really hard to design for. If we try, we can get most of the users with this, you know, 80% of the users with this design. But in order to get that last 20%, we're going to have to solve some really hard problems we don't know how to solve. So let's just get the problems we know how to solve done, get that out of the way. And So now we're suddenly in the realm of, okay, what does 80% of our users mean? Well, if I'm Facebook and I have 2 billion users, 80% of the users is 1.6 billion. So we've just left 400 million people off the table. We're saying, yeah, they're too hard to design for 400 million people. Well, that's a lot of people. I mean, yes. You know, there are, that's almost twice the population of the United States that we are leaving off the table and saying they're too hard to design for. And, you know, I know people in the United States, they are too hard to design for, but that's not the point.
Sure.
The point is that when we get into this realm of large numbers, data becomes really critical. And if we want to really account for most of those 400 million people that we just left off the table, we've got to really understand the differences between those people and what makes them unusual. If we say, okay, well, 10% of the people have some sort of issue with vision.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, out of 2 billion people, that's 200 million people with an issue with vision that we now need to do something about.
Yeah.
And we can no longer just say, well, that's just Bill. And, you know, he's in a corner. It's not just one person. It's 200 million people who have vision issues that we've decided not to deal with because dealing with someone with low vision is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And you get into these things, and particularly you want to talk about good design. Well, let's take something important like the design of election ballots. And let's take the fact that in the United States, 48% of adults read in a categorization called low literacy, ninth grade level or below.
Mm-hmm.
How do you design election ballots so those people's votes get counted the way that they feel when they will have trouble reading the ballot and understanding how to vote? And so now data becomes really critically important because we have to identify who those people are. We have to understand the way they behave and how it's different from other folks. And we have to make sure that if our goal is that every person votes the way they intend, that we make that ballot work. And, you know, not everything is as important as ballot, but there are safety instructions. There are financial instructions. It's not completely a coincidence that many people with low literacy are also in the lower end of the financial spectrum. They are often in poverty range. How do we help them get government services? How do we help them make sure they don't get taken advantage of by things like payday loans and understand those types of things? So there are all sorts of issues that come up because we need to understand the differences and we need to understand what works and what doesn't. And that's where data plays a role.
Yeah. So there are very real world negative and positive too, but real world consequences of bad design and applying data poorly to bad design. And
exactly
what it kind of comes down to for me, what I wrote down, what I keep writing down as I'm, you know, listening and looking for trends, it's about the users. It's about the people, right? That at the end of the day, why do we want to have good design? Why do we want to have awesome design? Because at the end of the day, we're helping some person or large groups of people. So if you ignore the data, if you ignore the percentages, or you just say, you know what, we're just going to do poor design because it doesn't matter, then that's not good. you are taking away the opportunity to help people, or you're hurting people. And I think that's so
exactly
often the talking about the users, talking about the people. That's really at the end of the day what this comes down to. And that we can often forget because we get stuck either with in the data analytics weeds or the design weeds, or what size should this button be? And just remembering that there's a person on the other end of that, that seems really, really key here.
Right, right. And also, behaviors are messy. People behave in interesting ways, and the choices they make are messy choices. And assuming that you know why someone clicked on something could be right, or you could be completely wrong.
Yeah.
And a lot of what happens is that we don't take into account, like we assume that if we're measuring things by conversion rate, and no one ever asked the question, but they need to be asking the question, what is the highest conversion rate we could expect? You know, if conversion rate is measured in terms of a number of people who purchase divided by the number of people who visit, mm-hmm. are we assuming that all visitors intend to purchase? Mm-hmm. Where did that assumption come from? And if we're saying, well, no, not all visitors intend to purchase, well, then how many do we intend to purchase? Right? Mm-hmm. Because the rest of them, we shouldn't expect to convert at all.
Yeah.
So why are we even looking at their data? Why? Let's just look at the data of the people who should have purchased. Mm-hmm. And let's see what the difference is between the people who should have purchased from the people who didn't, who purchased. But to do that, we have to separate out the people who should have purchased from the people who didn't purchase because they shouldn't. And in most data collection systems, we can't separate that data.
Yeah, that's hard.
And as a result, what are we actually trying to decide when we say, well, these people did X, but these other people did Y. But not all of the people are people who we should have gotten to convert. So what does getting them all to do X may not have worked? And we don't even know what success looks like in that situation. We can't say if our current conversion rate is at 15%, would a 100% successful conversion rate be 100? Would it be 50%? Would it be 17%? We don't know.
We don't. And that's people are messy. And that's a perfect example of the way that people are messy and the way that we look at data and the way that we decide to click and not to click. And so I'm writing this down as topic number two, conversion rates. This is something that you talked about at the Business of Software talk that definitely resonated with me as well. You know, we can end up talking for hours and hours, Jared, about this stuff. And I know we don't have that time today, but I am making a note to talk about conversion rates as well the next time we chat, because that's a huge topic. And it's worthy of really picking it apart in the way that I love you're picking apart all of these topics. And talking about the fact that people are messy, I think dovetails really nicely into the last question that I want to squeeze in here, because I do ask all of my podcast guests, for you, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
The biggest people-related challenge in my job. I would say it's understanding people,
yeah.
Right? It's understanding how people work and what makes people different, and how people who are designers or are people who are working on the design of something think about their customers, think about their challenges. I think right now that's probably the biggest thing. I think we're in this really interesting place where suddenly we are starting to pay attention to second order effects. You know, if we use this website for free and they sell all our data, are we happy about that? And up until now, the going theory was, well, people don't really care if you sell their data. They want the free thing, and that's just the price they pay, and they're paying it willingly. But I think after what we've seen in the last couple of years, people are waking up and saying, well, wait a second, some of that data I did not mean to sell. And now it's coming back to bite me. And, you know, when your car can report on everywhere you've been, will you be happy with people you don't know using that information to sell you things, to make decisions about you, to potentially creating a story about you that may or may not be true?
Yes.
And is that the choice you want?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, yeah, I love how you sort of took the idea that, yes, people are messy. Who are our users, right? Getting back to that, who are these people who are at the other end of the computer screen or tablet screen or iPhone screen that are looking at the stuff that we design? And then what are these? I love this concept of the second order effects of, you know, we're selling your data. How does that affect the users? And they're all thorny problems. They're complex problems. And I'm glad that you're bringing them up. And I'm glad that you're, you know, really picking them apart in a way that other folks haven't. And you have 70 years to figure them out, right? So
maybe.
This is a long game here.
Yes. We thought we had 70 years, but some of these problems are accelerating at a rate.
You're right.
I'm not sure we completely have 70 years to
figure
them
out. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
So. Well, and so it's great to know that there are folks who are on the front lines who are at least admitting that there are some issues going on here, and let's figure them out. I think the biggest thing that I've gotten out of our talk today, and thank you so much for taking the time again, was really just let's think about design not just from a data perspective, that's important, but let's also think about design from a human perspective as well, and let's put all of that together to make design and user interface and user interaction the best it could possibly be. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat today.
Oh, thank you.